Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Riverside, California. We have a very special guest in just a few moments. We'll be talking about the topic of hell. What happened to it? Our cultural conversation now largely lacks hell as anything other than a curse word. Hell has disappeared, been eclipsed off of the preaching in many churches. We're going to be looking at why that's so and why it's important to recover the biblical concept of hell. We're going to have an expert on the topic of hell, a religion professor here at California Baptist University, where I am visiting today, and we'll pick up with that and invite you to join us in that conversation in just a few moments. First, a review of issues in the news. At my website today at albertmohler.com, you will find a commentary. It was posted this morning on abortion as a moral issue. Let me tell you how that all came about. William Salatan of Slate.com wrote an article, an op-ed in the New York Times back on the day of the 33rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade back in January, in which he suggested that the pro-choice, pro-abortion movement needs to declare war on abortion. And what he meant was that they needed to draw down the total number of abortions. Even he, very much committed to the pro-choice position, said, look, 40 million aborted babies since 1973 is just an atrocity. We need to pull that number down. Recklessness, irresponsibility explains this. He is an ardent defender of abortion rights, but he said, look, we will gain in the public's respect if we will admit that abortion's bad. Shouldn't happen. Maybe a lamentable necessity, but shouldn't happen. If we can cut down the numbers, it will be much better. Katha Pollitt enters the scene in the pages of The Nation, one of the most left-wing magazines in America. Katha Pollitt's kind of your trademark liberal, and she came back to say, look, I'm offended that William Salatan says that abortion's bad. She says it's not. The moment you begin bringing morality into it, she says you're going to stigmatize women who get abortions. You're going to stigmatize abortion providers. And by the way, when was the last time you saw a bright young medical student say, when I grow up and when I get my practice, I want to be an abortionist? Of course it's stigmatized. We know what it is. And William Salatan says, look, it's time we who are on the pro-abortion side admit that, the pro-choice side, as he would construe it. And Katha Pollitt said no. Well, then, from the pages of the New York Times and The Nation, they entered into a direct debate at Slate.com. The links to it will be on my website, but the article's there is at albertmohler.com. Today's commentary, it's very interesting because here's the deal. William Salatan is saying there's a race to the middle in America. There's a race to those who are undecided on the issue of abortion. He says, look, The pro-life cause has made enormous strides, enormous gains in recent years because, now listen carefully, he says, they're focusing on the preborn baby. They're focusing on the fetus. He said, that's a loser for us. Because the moment you begin to think about the fetus, abortion becomes more and more to look like murder. Surprise, surprise. And of course, there are other things going here. Technology, ultrasound. We're now looking at the pictures of these developing preborn human beings, and the moral atrocity of abortion is becoming, well, more and more clear to many, many Americans. He said, look, we just need to admit that. We need to admit abortion's a horrible thing. We think it still should be legal. It should be a woman's choice, but we need to help women to make that choice as infrequently as possible. Katha Pollitt says no. But William Salatan's right. There is a race to the middle. Because any way you look at it, the polling data tells us a couple of things that are important for those of us who value life at every stage to remember, and that is that Americans are beginning to feel really, really troubled about the entire abortion question. And it is because of the fetus. It is because of the ultrasound images. It is because, I think, of the lingering conscience. Now, 30-plus years after Roe v. Wade, where the death toll has been mounting, I think that's beginning to weigh heavily on the conscience of the nation. But at the same time, some bare majority, or at least a plurality of Americans, appears to say, we don't want all abortions to be restricted. There is a race to the middle, and we need to get there. It's very clear to us that William Salatan and Katha Pollitt are debating how their side should get there. We need to get there with cogent arguments about why we should value human life in every form, at every stage, from conception until natural death. And, folks, every once in a while, it's good to read the other side's mail, and when they publish it on their own website, it's an open invitation to find out what they're thinking so we can reframe our debate as well. Issues of the sanctity of human life also come back to questions about humans and animals, oddly enough. George Will's column in Newsweek from a couple of weeks ago I have linked to on my website today because the issue of animal rights and pet rights now all of a sudden is in the news again, with the Labour government in Great Britain suggesting that animals should be recognized as having several enumerated rights, including, this is my favorite one, a right to companionship or solitude as the animal prefers. A constitutional right to companionship or solitude. I am the proud owner of a beagle. Now, I realize that's politically incorrect. We're not supposed to say pets anymore, and we're not owners. We are companion animals. So I am the companion to a beagle, and the beagle's a companion to me. But you know what? I don't think he ever wants solitude. He wants to be with me all the time. But I don't think he has a constitutional right to have companionship all the time. Every once in a while, he's left alone. Well, the Labour government in Great Britain says that's an infringement of this animal's innate right. George Will comes back and just mentions that this is absolute nonsense, and he questions how this relates to the bigger issue of government. What is government's role in all of this, and how would government's role be construed in a situation in which, if animals have rights, they should have advocates. If they have advocates, they should have attorneys. If they have attorneys, they're going to have lobbying groups. You know, what comes up next? And by the way, this doesn't end with dogs and cats. It goes on to gerbils. Yes, they even mention gerbils. A gerbil rights movement? Well, this is what happens when the Christian worldview collapses. Because what you have is a collapsing of the hierarchy between human beings and other animals. You have the loss of that distinction. And let's remember that the Christian worldview begins with the affirmation that the same God made the gerbil as made human beings. But he made human beings alone in his image. The imago Dei, the image of God, is that which makes human beings categorically different from all other forms of life. And the collapsing of that distinction is just one other way of cheapening human life in our times. You think you've seen it all, but then you're reminded that not yet. It's not over. And especially on questions of life, we're continually told by the other side that it's wrong to make the slippery slope argument. Just take the Netherlands, the culture of death, the embrace of euthanasia. First, it was passive euthanasia, not active euthanasia. And it was voluntary euthanasia, not involuntary euthanasia. But now we know there is both active and involuntary euthanasia. We know that there is an official protocol at Groningen University for the euthanizing of children, even without parental permission. And now, a Dutch politician by the name of Alderman Marianne van den Anker has called for mandated abortion for the children of immigrants, the children that are produced by abuse, and other things where we are told, according to van den Anker, that they will not be loved as they ought to be loved. In other words, she's suggesting that a panel of judges should force women to have abortions when these judges feel like whatever child could be born from this pregnancy will not be adequately loved. Folks, you can't make this stuff up. It's just a reminder of the kind of moral slide that is inevitable when human dignity is assaulted and when this kind of confusion becomes the order of the day. Other things going on in the world that should command our attention, Yale University has a new student. I'm here on a university campus. Let me tell you, this is always across America where the battle of ideas really takes place. And, of course, the parameters of those ideas are very important. No one's completely open-minded, and no institution's completely open-minded. So when you allow something, you're making some declaration. And Yale has now accepted Rahmatullah Hashimi, the former ambassador-at-large for the Taliban, as a student. Ambassador Hashimi admits that he could just as likely be in Guantanamo Bay as at Yale. Now, why would Yale accept someone who had been the front man for a known world terrorist organization? As a matter of fact, Ambassador Hashimi had appeared in the media defending the Taliban and its brutal regime and its destruction of antiquities and the sites there throughout modern-day Iraq and what took place in Afghanistan. And yet, Mr. Rahmatullah, he, by the way, and that's the way you say it, his full name is Syed Rahmatullah Hashimi, and the surname is the middle name. Mr. Rahmatullah told the New York Times, quote, "I'm the luckiest person in the world. I could have ended up in Guantanamo Bay. Instead, I ended up at Yale." Now, just when you start to make fun of this, you realize that Yale gives you even more information. The dean of admissions at Yale said that the university had had another foreigner of Mr. Ramatula's caliber apply for special student status, and, quote, this is Richard Shaw, Yale's dean of undergraduate admissions, who said, quote, "We lost him to Harvard, and I don't want that to happen again." That's right. We lost one terrorist to Harvard. We're not going to lose a second one, said the dean of admissions at Yale. Folks, I just have to mark the passing of Don Knotts, a man who gave so much humor to so many millions of Americans, including me and my family, deserves a word of tribute here. And this is not a matter of great moral meaning, other than the fact that Don Knotts showed us that we could laugh in a way that was never coarse and never mean and never cheap. He helped Americans to see what life was lived as Deputy Barney Fife. He made a name for his nervousness and anxiety and awkwardness. I have no idea whether he was really as happy and as funny a person in life as he appeared on the screen. We're often told that some of the funniest people on stage and screen live some of the most unhappy lives. I hope that wasn't the case for Don Knotts. And I'm very thankful that he gave us an example of how to laugh in a way that was clean and wholesome. He taught us all to nip it in the bud. We'll be right back to open the big question of hell, live from Riverside, California. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Today we're going to be talking about the eclipse of hell. And we're going to be talking about the publication of a book entitled Hell Under Fire. The editors of that book, Christopher W. Morgan and Robert A. Peterson, we're going to have as our guest today, Dr. Morgan, who serves as Associate Dean and Associate Professor of Theology, the School of Christian Ministries at California Baptist University in Riverside, California. I've been here on that campus today of California Baptist University. I've had a great time visiting with students, speaking, and meeting with the faculty. This is a beautiful place. Chris Morgan, it must be a real burden to teach here.
Oh, we love it. We love it. There's 20 million people within 2 hours of here, and we have an opportunity to spread the word through Southern California.
I'm impressed with your students. I had a great time speaking in the auditorium, had a Q&A time at the end. They seem to be pretty bright.
Yeah, most of them are very bright, very eager, very diligent, wanting to know more about God, His Word, and how they can relate that to this culture.
Yeah, I was really impressed. We were talking about issues of ministry and Christian life in a postmodern age, talking about evangelism, apologetics, and an entire catalog of things. And you can really get a clear sense, a kind of a barometer about what's going on campus by the students, the questions that students ask, and by the students, their attentiveness, and all the rest. I was very impressed with this. Look, when you're teaching college students here in Southern California, you're in a Baptist university, a Christian university, that takes the Christian faith very seriously. You know, I think there are a lot of people around the country who would say, look, the stronger your belief system, the clearer your convictions, you're really going to chase a lot of students off. Is that what you find?
No, the school's really boomed since. The school's grown from 800 students to 3,100 students since we've turned theologically careful and theologically conservative.
Well, that's really encouraging, and I guess a part of that is you talk about some things others don't want to talk about, like hell.
Right.
All right. You and I really came to know each other as we were talking about this project, really about hell under fire, and we were looking at the eclipse of hell in contemporary theology, and not only that, in church life and ministry. And it has happened. I mean, by any measure, you just take what's gone on, even in some evangelical circles, Dr. Morgan, you start looking and you realize there are a lot of people who might believe in hell, they just never talk about it. You wouldn't know it. And then there's, I like this, there's a contemporary Roman Catholic writer who simply put it this way. He said there are a lot of people who are trying to air condition hell. And they're simply trying to take the sting out of it. Why did you and Robert Peterson decide that it was timely to produce a book on hell?
Well, it seems like hell is interacting with some of the most difficult and important issues facing the Christian worldview. And hell, in particular, has been omitted from many of the pulpits of Christian churches around the country.
Well, why? I mean, there has to be some reason for this. It's not like the Bible never mentions it. Jesus talks more about hell than about heaven. You just look at the concordance. There are more references to hell than heaven. I think that's partly because it's a harder concept for us to come to terms with. But, I mean, there's really no doubt that it plays a major function in the preaching of Jesus and in the structure of the New Testament. So how did it disappear?
Well, in a culture where all ideas are created equal rather than just all people are created equal, it seems that this pluralistic tendency that our culture has makes preaching hell maybe the most politically incorrect thing you can do.
You know, in the chapter I wrote for your book, and I was privileged to write the introductory chapter, which was an historical review of the question, what happened to hell, a part of what I tried to look at is the fact that, well, let's put it this way. As Martin Luther the Reformer made clear, in the 16th century, just to go back, you know, it's not like you're reaching back to Moses there. That's just 400 years back, but worldviewishly, that's a long time back. Martin Luther said, look, most people wake up afraid that they will, during the course of that day, die and go to hell. I don't think most Americans wake up with much fear that they're going to die and go to hell.
No, in fact, last year, L.A. Times ran a report, 2005, that 1% of Americans considered themselves to have a good chance of going to hell. So, yeah, 63% said they believed in the existence of some sort of hell. So, two-thirds of Americans believe in the existence of hell, but I guess only Osama bin Laden might go there.
Yeah, you know, I think that's very interesting. I've been asked this on so many television programs and other things, you know, who actually goes there? And, you know, I've talked to TV hosts who have said, well, I can picture a place where Adolf Hitler would be in hell, or Idi Amin, or Charles Manson, or, as you say, Osama bin Laden, although he's still alive right now, so far as we know. You know, you start looking at it, and people say, look, in the moral calculation, I figure I'm doing pretty well. Hell has to be for the most awful, the most extreme, egregious sinners, and I don't have to worry about going there because I'm a pretty good person.
Right, because our culture minimizes the biblical doctrine of sin. We don't see ourselves as guilty. We don't see ourselves as under the judgment of a just God.
One of the things I looked at in my chapter is how theologians have started to really kind of trim the corners, you know, on this. They're trying to round it out. It reminds me, by the way, when I'm in Southern California, of one of Peter DeVries' novels about a very progressive Southern California preacher who preached in only a round sanctuary, in a round pulpit, because he wanted nothing with hard edges. And, you know, I'm sure that's not true of everyone in Southern California, I'm glad to say. But nonetheless, nationwide, in fact, all throughout the Western world, there's this desire to kind of, you know, smooth things out. Let's just avoid that. I am shocked at how many preachers never get within the neighborhood of a clear reference to hell. They never warn against hell. I heard someone the other day tell me, listen, I'm tired of hearing hellfire and brimstone sermons. I asked him, I said, well, honestly, tell me the last place you heard one. I want to find that preacher.
Yeah, I would say that. So often the preachers even end up saying either go to heaven or then they can't figure out what to say after that, some other place or the other place.
Yeah,
let's say the word hell.
Let's remember the words of Jesus who said, fear not the one who can destroy the body, but fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. You know, very clear references. And, you know, when I was in seminary, you know, years ago, when theological liberalism was something that you know, we had to worry about, one of the things that I was told was it was immoral to encourage persons to come to Christ out of fear of hell. And you know what? I find that to be an immoral argument.
Right, right. Because the gospel is the backdrop for the doctrine of hell. God created us. We're accountable to God. We've blown it in our accountability to God. We're therefore guilty and sinners. Christ is the only way to God. And if we do not trust him, we have to pay the consequences ourselves. That's just the nature of substitutionary atonement. The doctrine of hell is the flip side of that.
Absolutely. And, of course, you take, for instance, the classic Christian sermon on hell. If there's any one sermon on hell people know about from the history of the Christian church, much less American history, it's Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, by Jonathan Edwards. And, you know, I can remember the first time I read that, I was an 11th grader, and it was in an English class. And I can remember the teacher saying, I know most of you, and this is 1970s, progressive South Florida, liberal teacher who said, look, I know most of you can't believe anyone ever believed this. But just try to forget that it was a sermon and just try to read it as literature. And I remember reading that thinking, I'm not finding anything I disagree with here. As a matter of fact, I was fairly petrified when I read the sermon, and Edwards talked about walking on a tissue where you feel like you're on soft ground, and at any moment you can fall through that tissue into the pits of hell. I can tell you, as a 16-year-old, that really had my attention. I fear that millions of Americans, even attending churches that they think are largely evangelical and conservative, have no fear of hell. You know, even, and I'm so thankful, even Luther, you know, just really emphasized that even the Christians should have the fear of hell. Not the fear lest, having come to Christ, we should go there, but the fear to see so many around us so obstinately headed there.
That's right. I would say most churches are avoiding the issue, unfortunately, although I think there's a resurgence coming of preachers who are willing to tackle the issue and deal straightforwardly with the doctrine of hell.
Okay. That was Dr. Chris Morgan of California Baptist University, the co-editor of the book Hell Under Fire. That's what we're talking about. Hell is under fire, and by the way, it has been for some time. But what about in your church? What about in your conversation? Now's the opportunity for you to join us. Call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. What happened to hell? Do you hear hell referenced from the pulpit of your church? Whether you're a church member, a pastor, or just someone driving along concerned about what's going on in America today and in our churches, what happened to hell? Call us. 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello again. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The topic today is hell. What happened to it? For a lot of people, it's nothing more than an epithet, a curse word. But when you look at the Bible, hell is a very important part of the foreground and the background. As the background, in terms of eternity, it reminds us of the absolute assurance and perfection of God's judgment, of the wrath that is to come, of the fact that sin has consequences. And there are clear biblical warnings that we should flee hell. We should flee to Christ in order to avoid hell. And it's in the foreground because hell is a reminder to us of the urgency of the whole question of the gospel. It's not just a hypothetical thing, as E.Y. Mullins, a great Baptist theologian of the turn of the last century, said, God doesn't treat the gospel as if it's simply an apple set on the ground in case anyone should desire it. God shows that, makes it desirable, and shows the consequences of not accepting the gospel, of not coming to Christ. My guest today is Dr. Chris Morgan. He's associate dean and associate professor in the School of Christian Ministries at California Baptist University. He is also the co-editor of the book, Hell Under Fire. You know, Chris, there has to be a little irony in that title.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, there has been a series of other books. There was Jesus Under Fire, and there's God Under Fire. Just talking about the fact that these doctrines are under attack. But the poetry of Hell Under Fire is particularly interesting. In fact, in my chapter as a theologian looking at the history of this doctrine, one of the things I had to deal with is how many contemporary theologians don't want to talk about hell in terms of the biblical picture. They want to talk about it as alienation or estrangement. They don't want to talk about it as conscious torment. But there's really no way around that, is there?
Right. Hell in the Bible is mostly pictured as punishment, conscious punishment due our sin from our guilt.
Folks, to join the conversation, the phone number is 877-893-8255. Coast to call, just call. Coast to coast, just call. Toll free, 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Jason, listening to XM170 from Atlanta, Georgia. Go ahead, Jason.
Al, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm honored, and I just wanted to say that I think that the problem where hell has gone in the Christian domain is related to moral relativism. I taught high school biology and chemistry for 9 years as a Christian, and you know what I was told to teach those kids in that realm, and then what they learn in their psychology, sociology classes, is to tolerate everyone's ideas, and to, you know, everyone's okay, it's all right. And I think honestly that hell has been tolerated so much that we're going to tolerate people right into hell.
Christians. I think you're right. Yeah, Jason, I think you make a very perceptive point. This culture of tolerance, and by the way, we've so corrupted that word that it no longer means what it once meant. Its dictionary definition has been really supplanted by the idea that it means that everyone's right. And, you know, by the way, it doesn't mean that everyone's wrong and has a right to be wrong. It now means that everybody's right. And what's really interesting is, and I face this in a lot of my engagement in the media on a question like this, people, when they hear us talk about hell, think that we find pleasure in thinking there will be people there, in pleasure in the doctrine of hell. Well, you know, that's not the Christian motivation. The Christian motivation is to see as many persons come to Christ as is possible by the preaching of the gospel so that they will not end up in hell. But you know what? It's kind of like, and I use this metaphor a lot, whether it's the problem of sin or the reality of hell. If you know that someone has cancer, if you're the doctor and you know that they have cancer, it's, according to today's politically correct culture, intolerant and insensitive to tell them they're going to die. But you know what? They're going to die anyway. And it's simply the truth. It's a truth they need to know because it's a truth that they could then use to seek a cure, to seek cancer surgery, to do something about it, chemotherapy and radiation. It's absolutely insane to say that telling someone the truth about their peril is somehow insensitive. But that's where we are on hell. My guest today, again, is Dr. Chris Morgan of California Baptist University. Chris, you know, how did this get so contorted into sentiment rather than a question of truth?
Well, it's interesting because Jesus, the most loving person ever, obviously, is the one that spoke most often about hell. So hell is not inconsistent with a view of love. It's not inconsistent with loving people. The most loving person ever emphasized it.
And Jesus himself said, and I've quoted this verse before from Matthew, fear not he who can destroy the body, but he can destroy with body and soul in hell. Speaking of the Father as judge. And, you know, he wouldn't talk about hell if he didn't mean to warn us about it. And again, in this cult of sensitivity, you have too many preachers who worried about, well, maybe in the first place making someone angry, but in the second place making anyone uncomfortable. And you know what? Hell makes us uncomfortable. But the gospel makes us uncomfortable. The diagnosis of sin makes us uncomfortable. And it's exactly the kind of discomfort that we should pray for. Because it's the kind of discomfort that leads persons to understand their need for Christ. Folks, toll-free coast-to-coast, the number is 877-893-8255. You need to join this conversation. What do you have to say about the disappearance of hell? 877-893-8255. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. It's a rainy day in Riverside, California. I didn't think this ever happened out here. Does it ever rain? Every day seems to be beautiful.
At least 4 days a year it rains.
4 days a year. All right. Well, it's a beautiful place. I've enjoyed being here at CBU. My guest today is Chris Morgan, who is Associate Dean and Associate Professor of Theology at California Baptist University. He's the co-editor of the book Hell Under Fire. And it is. It is under fire, that is. That's what we've been talking about. I had the honor of being a contributor to that book, wrote the first chapter, which is a theological review of what happened. But there are other chapters in the book that deal with pastoral applications, biblical questions, and all the rest. But here's the bottom line. You know, it really doesn't matter if you believe in hell, if you're a preacher, and you never mention it. You know, it's this culture of political correctness. I mean, it does matter, but not to the people who are hearing you. And I think this culture has just intimidated so many people from telling the truth. We have Chuck on the line, listening on XM170 from Charlotte, North Carolina. Chuck, what do you think about all this?
Oh, man. Just want to say I love your show. I guess, you know, you kind of stole a lot of my thunder with the political correctness. But I think there's a lot of pastors out there, not all of them, but they're afraid if they offend a lot of the people. You know, people want to hold on to their sin and come to church and be made to feel good. You know, if they get offended, I think a lot of the pastors are afraid that they won't, you know, show up at church. And one other comment I wanted to make, it has a lot to do with what you talked about last week about the whole Dolly Parton thing. You know, a lot of people think that, you know, really there is no hell. That you basically can, you know, God's going to love you no matter how you are. But that's all I had, and I'll listen out there. Thank you.
Well, Chuck, I really appreciate that call, and you had plenty of thunder there. I think when you make the point that many pastors fear their own people, there's a lot of thunder that. I appreciate hearing one layman call with that concern. I think, by the way, this is one reminder that if you're a layman in a local church, you're a layperson, especially if you're a layman who has a relationship with your pastor, and I hope you do, encourage him. Let him know that he's not alone in this. Let him know that there's a group of godly Christians who are going to support him in preaching the whole counsel of God, including the doctrine of hell. Just remind him of his accountability before God as the steward of the word. You know, I love that metaphor from the New Testament of the pastor as the steward of the mysteries of God. You know, we get to talk about these things, but we don't get to pick and choose. We don't get to say we're going to talk about heaven, but we're never going to warn people about hell. We're going to talk about this, but we're never going to talk about that. You know, we're living in one of these days in which some people come to church for therapy. You know, that's the other problem. They come wanting to be reassured. You know, here's one of the things. I dare you to read the four Gospels and find a crowd who heard Jesus speak who left reassured. You're just not going to find it. Jesus upset everybody because he told them the truth. And by the way, most of the people who came just to hear what he had to say, you know, whether it was the Pharisees or whatever, to trip him up, they left angry. Because they were spiritually resistant. But it was those who were the poor in spirit, those who were desperate to hear how they might know the love of God, who left with their lives transformed. And, you know, Jesus warned them about hell. Let's go to Randy, listening on WFIA, calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Randy, good to hear from you. Your turn.
Yes, I agree 100% with what you're saying. And my question is, at our church, I'm pastors mention hell. They talk about hell. But one of the things that confuses me is with new converts, they're told, well, you know, you confessed your belief, and you've been saved. And I feel like a lot of Christians feel like, okay, I'm saved, that's it. My work is done. Our pastor do tell us that you will face judgment. And what is the punishment for us Christians? We say we believe, we confess our belief, but we really don't change our ways. Is it hell, or just what is that fear factor that keeps us on the path?
Randy, what a big question. You know, wow. Thanks for calling with that, because you help us really to tie it all together. You know, when you start talking about the big question, what do Christians have to fear from hell? I think we have to fear being revealed by our cowardice, being revealed in our lack of faithfulness, as we see that that hell is populated by those, some of whom didn't hear the gospel from us or didn't hear a clear presentation from us. Now, let me get back to the central part of your question, Randy. What do Christians have to fear from hell? Nothing personally and directly, because as those who are in Christ, Christ is our advocate, and we will be judged. And by the way, all of our sins and misdeeds, every thought and every action will be shown to us in that judgment. And the guilt will be clear, but the guilt will be taken up by Christ. Because on the cross, as our substitute, he paid the full penalty for our sin. He's not only our advocate, he is our substitute. He was the lamb who was slain, whose blood bought, purchased our redemption. So we have no fear of hell. There's no way a Christian is going to be in hell, and nor, by the way, is there any kind of purgation. You know, the unbiblical doctrine of purgatory. There isn't something that is left deficient in Christ's work, such that there's something to be burned out of us, or some punishment that we have to bear short of hell. No, Jesus paid it all. That's what the old song says. Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. That's the altogether, all-comprehensive work of Christ. But, you know, we do have a judgment to fear, and that's the judgment of being revealed in our sin and the sheer awfulness and ugliness of it being demonstrated by the holy God who created us and will hold us accountable. But there is nothing that we have to claim as a plea other than the blood of Christ. And for those who are in Christ, he is not only our advocate, he is our substitute, and we will bear his imputed righteousness even in that judgment, and thus we'll be accepted by God, not on the basis of anything in us, but of the atonement that was accomplished by Christ. Chris, when you think about this, Dr. Chris Morgan, Associate Dean, Associate Professor of Theology here at California Baptist University, when Christians ask you, why should I be concerned about hell, what do you say?
Well, I think that we Christians need to understand that hell plays an important part of the Christian worldview, and that even though preachers were completely been maybe worried about the fact the pastors haven't been preaching on it significantly enough, that doesn't mean that hell is the central message. Christ is the central message, but Christ cannot be understood unless sin is understood, and sin will not be fully understood unless the doctrine of hell is developed. And so it's not as if we're saying that hell is the theme of the Bible. Hell is a backdrop to the theme of the Bible.
Yes, it is a backdrop. And, of course, judgment itself is the backdrop. And the big picture behind that is the holiness of God and God's absolute justice and righteousness. And that's why we just need to remind ourselves over and over again of the comprehensive interconnectedness of biblical truth. You know, that's the real problem. You know, someone says, well, I'm gonna go soft on this doctrine. They probably wouldn't put it that way. But, you know, it's just, you don't have to stress this. That's the way they put it. You don't have to stress that. You don't have to say that. But when you leave something that's so clearly revealed in the Bible undeveloped, then every other doctrine suffers, because no one really understands how the righteousness of God leads immediately to his judgment, which leads to hell, and how hell is the ultimate fulfillment of the wrath of God, which is righteously poured out. So righteously that even those who go there will agree that it's right that there they should go. We'll be right back with some final thoughts. I'm Albert Mohler. Whatever happened to hell? That's a big question. Because in a lot of churches, you don't hear it much anymore. And I want to be fair. There are a lot of churches that are preaching. There are a lot of faithful pastors who are putting themselves on the line for biblical truth. And to you pastors, I just want to say God bless you. To those of you in those churches, just affirm your pastor. Just thank him for being faithful in doing what is politically incorrect in this culture, and what, frankly, gets a lot of pastors very few thanks even from within the congregation. But this is a part of the Word of God, and honorable is he who preaches the Word of God, the whole counsel of God. Very quickly, let's go to Harold calling from Holland, Michigan. Go ahead, Harold.
Yeah, Dr. Mueller, could you clarify for me what seems to be a mixed metaphor? Jesus said, cast the servant into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth, with the concept of fire of hell, which illuminates. So you've got darkness and you have brightness.
Yes, and you mentioned that as a mixed metaphor. Of course, it is in our imagination, because we think of fire as emitting light as well as heat. And then we hear hell referred to as outer darkness and all the rest. I think the honest answer to that, Harold, is that it's impossible for us consciously to come to terms with the physicality and the awfulness of hell. And so we have a multiplicity of metaphors to help us to understand the physical torment and the darkness, the complete absence of truth. Chris Morgan, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I agree completely. But I also think that a couple years ago we had the California fires out here. For the first time it hit me that if I was describing the destruction that was taking place when I was watching the fires come down at night down the mountain, what I would have described was fire and blackest darkness. And so I think this imagery of cities burning, things being destroyed, are apt metaphors, and they aren't inconsistent with one another.
You know, one of the things I often tell people is that they got to get beyond a cartoon understanding of hell. Because they picture Satan with a big grin and a pitchfork and, you know, all these people with smoke and lava and everything. And that's not only cartoons. That's also artists like Doré and, of course, works like Dante's Inferno, where you have all this. We need to get back to the Bible. That's a good place to start. The Bible is a very straightforward and honest presentation of hell. And the utter finality of hell is the great warning, and the utter horror of it. The brimstone, the fire, the worm that does not turn nor is burned. These are horrible pictures of torment. And as insensitive as some people think it is to talk about these things in an eternal perspective with the gospel on the line, it would be not only insensitive not to talk about them, it would be an act of faithlessness. It will be an act of arrogant faithlessness to say, I know Jesus talked about hell. I know the Bible's clear about hell. I'm just not going to talk about it. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation every weekday, just at this time. Tomorrow we'll be here to talk about the return of patriarchy. Not in a Christian magazine. That's the cover story in Foreign Policy this month. We'll talk about why. I'll meet you tomorrow. This is Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent...